Welcome to Focus Black Oklahoma. I'm Ariel Davis.
And I'm Colby Webster. Gentrification, eminent domain, big strategic land buys, and more are affecting Tulsa's downtown and adjacent neighborhoods. I sat down with Becky Gligo, the Housing Policy Director for the City of Tulsa Mayor's Office, to touch on the basics of connecting neighbors, organizing, the characteristics of strong neighborhoods, and addressing their concerns.
If you could touch on what makes these inner ring neighborhoods so important to a thriving downtown that is changing so much.
Yeah, I mean, one, they are, to me, the historical heart of Tulsa. When you drive through these neighborhoods, you see Tulsa history unfold in front of you. These are beautiful homes. These are homes that I've met a lot of people who will tell me my grandparents lived at this house. So they're part of the identity of the city. The other thing is that do we want affordability downtown in that inner downtown core? Absolutely. Is that a goal that we're going to continue to fight for and that you'll see in the strategy? Absolutely. But at the end of the day, why they're important is because they're kind of the heart and history of the city.
Becky and I went over pressing housing issues affecting downtown and the surrounding neighborhoods of Tulsa.
I know with Crosby Heights, in speaking to some of their residents, they're very concerned about outside investment. Will they have a say in what the future development looks like in their neighborhood? And right now, we don't have a lot of guardrails around things like who can acquire property at the county tax auction and what those developments look like. Oklahoma is a property rights state, and it sort of functions like a free market in that way. What we saw with the Pearl District is too many years ago, there were a lot of inclusive conversations with those neighbors, and then things didn't happen. And then we started to move forward and enact plans based on those prior conversations without re-engaging the neighborhood the way we should have. And we saw the system work, in my mind, exactly like it needed to, which was the neighbor said, this is not what we want. They engaged their city councilor, and things changed very quickly. You do have health and safety issues in the Pearl when you talk about floodplain and flood damage to certain homes. I think what we saw, though, is that the path forward needs to involve neighborhood voice, and it will, because they gathered together and said, this is not how we want to see the city move.
Historically, North Tulsa has been perceived as a hotbed of crime. As a result, it has been neglected and generalized as unsafe instead of as an area with many communities with needs and solutions unique to its neighborhood-level obstacles. Gligo offered new insight as to how we view Northern Tulsa and how city councilors and neighborhood associations are creating solutions that start at the community level.
So then it leads us to perhaps the most vulnerable community residents of North Tulsa.
I mean, I think just geographically, North Tulsa is huge, right? And you have a very diverse set of neighborhoods, whether you're talking about Dunbar-Lacey Park or Patrick Heights, you're talking about Turley, the Greenwood Historic District. These are very unique neighborhoods with unique needs and unique perspectives. And so I do get nervous anytime we talk about a region or a geographic swath as if it's all one thing. And I think that actually kind of disrespects the magic of North Tulsa, which is there's just a lot of history and perspective and culture deep in there. I think that what we are seeing that's really powerful is that Councillor Hall Harper and Terry McGee have assembled the District 1 Housing Committee, which does encompass a lot of that larger region, North Tulsa, but it has representatives from those unique neighborhoods and those unique districts who can kind of talk about their own self-determination. And we're seeing the rise of some pretty powerful neighborhood associations. I think they've been very clear even at the state level about what they need to take their neighborhood to the place that they want to take it.
Noting history and perspective, I asked Gligo about the validity of fear and skepticism in these communities surrounding eminent domain, gentrification, and blight.
I think the most important thing to start with is the acknowledgement that that fear and mistrust didn't appear out of nowhere, and the reaction to terms like eminent domain and blight are the direct results of decades of historically racist housing policy, whether we're talking about urban renewal or redlining. Those are real, and they did happen here in Tulsa as well. And so I think communities that were systematically disinvested from over time have a right to be skeptical of any city interventions or private interventions in their neighborhoods, because traditionally they have not benefited the people who have lived there for a really long time.
Looking forward, Gligo puts an emphasis on the city of Tulsa communicating clearly with citizens, highlighting services, and making inclusive actions to solve problems.
I think it would be disingenuous to say that we won't ever see eminent domain happen in Tulsa again. That's just not real. But what the city has stepped back, and I think TDA has also stepped back and has really made a commitment to that I think is important, is that eminent domain would always be a tool of last resort, that it would only be used in cases where the city councilors approved, where the community had a say in spaces that it might be implemented, and that when we talk about things like blight, we need to be very clear that these are unoccupied units. So I know that there's fear, you know, if I own my home and maybe it's been in my family for generations, but I don't have the resources right now to fix the roof, are you going to take that away from me when this is something that we've held on to? It's precious to us in our history. No. What I'd rather see is that we as a city are positioning ourselves to intervene in ways that lift up neighborhoods without displacing folks.
As the nation gears up for the 2020 election, immigration is a topic on many voters' minds. And while the conversation can be contentious, not every immigrant has the same backstory or point of origin, as we hear in this next piece from Anissa West.
Public discourse about immigration often suggests that DACA recipients are only people who entered the U.S. unlawfully from Central America. Of the nearly 700,000 reported DACA recipients, the vast majority are from Mexico and other Central American countries, but nearly 100,000 are not. Nearly 5,000 are from countries in Africa. I recently sat down with a DACA recipient from Ghana who resides in northeastern Oklahoma. To protect her identity, we'll call her by her traditional name, Payan. She is the primary caregiver for her twin sister, who has special needs and is also a DACA recipient. Payan describes their immigration status as documented as opposed to undocumented. The average American might describe them as dreamers.
So being documented has honestly changed my life. Before, I couldn't work. I was in college and also dependent on my parents' visa status. And for us, the next step for that would either be to get our green card or apply for that visa or a visa, which would probably be an F1 student visa. The impact of DACA on my family and I, specifically my twin sister and I, is that we're able to live a normal life. We're able to work. We're able to pay our taxes. We're able to tithe. We're able to participate in community events and volunteer our time. Obviously, can't vote, but I love to help and encourage candidates. I'm very active in political circles. And so just showing different perspectives of the different kind of people that we have and showing how we can still thrive in communities. So DACA has allowed me personally to thrive, and it has allowed my twin sister to be less invisible. I say this because she is a Black woman, she's an immigrant, and then she has special needs. And so that is three times being invisible. And for her, having the possibility or the advantage of working, paying her taxes, being able to purchase things, allows her to be seen, allowing her to have a community with the people that she wants to be communal with. And then also seeing me thrive in the professional world, or seeing her thrive in her professional world, is honestly very helpful.
Unlike its predecessor, the DREAM Act, DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, does not provide lawful status or a path to citizenship.
And it's very unnerving sometimes because it threatens our livelihood. And right now, I'm sure you can see that people with DACA have become a bargaining chip for politics in D.C. And we would like for them to understand and know that we're humans, we're people, we're not pawns. We have lives, we have families, and we've invested so much of ourselves for years. The average documented person has at least lived in the U.S. for 10 to 15 years. And we've poured that much of our lives into this country, and we deserve a right to a clear path to citizenship so we can continue to grow and continue to invest in this country that we call home.
Although most Americans use dreamer to describe people who are documented, as Payen points out, that term is not one size fits all.
Yes, dreamers is a very nice posh word to categorize a group of people that are very resilient, but they're go-getters, they're trailblazers, and they're world changers. And if this country doesn't recognize that and find ways to keep them, good ways to keep them and show their value, these people are going to go to anywhere else in the world and they're going to thrive, because that's the kind of people they are. You can't knock them down. So dreamers is nice, but trailblazers is better.
For Focus Black Oklahoma, I'm Anissa West.
You're listening to Focus Black Oklahoma. And now, Crystal Patrick shares the moving, true story of a formerly incarcerated woman and how she is working to change the prison system for other women who are justice involved.
The state of Oklahoma leads the nation in the number of incarcerated women. Damaria Monday is a community activist and also a formerly incarcerated woman.
I rode the Greyhound bus when I was released from prison. I relocated to Oklahoma. I had a federal case for conspiracy to distribute 50 grams or more of cocaine base, also known as crack. So I had a 10-year mandatory minimum sentence as a first-time nonviolent offender. And so at the end of my sentence, I was coming home and I wanted a change, and I came in Tulsa.
What have you been doing since you've been out of prison?
I've been doing everything. Some of the things that I've been doing, because I came home from prison and my first thing was to get my child, because I had a child before I went to prison that I was separated from. You know, I left him when he was 6 months old, and I didn't get him back until he was 8 years old.
Wow.
Yes. And so my first goal was to work and to get a place. And so I got a place, and I was able to reunite with him. And then I started going to school and I got a degree. I have an associate's in business administration. And then also I have a bachelor's in entrepreneurship from Oklahoma State University.
Of all the many injustices Ms. Monday witnessed while incarcerated, one in particular led her to co-author legislation with Representative Regina Goodwin. House Bill 3393 is Oklahoma's anti-shackling bill. The practice of shackling pregnant women is reminiscent of the days of slavery.
So I wasn't shackled during childbirth. I had my baby before prison. However, you know, just to know that that happens and to hear another woman's pain and to think about how our ancestors were shackled and chained on the slave ships, you know, I felt compelled to do something. And so I told Representative Regina Goodwin about it, and I kept sharing more and more stories with her so she would know that it was real. And there was a time span of 20 years where it happened to women of all colors. And so she knew it was real. And so from there, then HB 3393, that's how it came about. And so HB 3393 was a grassroots organized effort. And so it was the power of the people that got the bill passed.
The bill doesn't just prohibit shackling. It also mandates that women can have access to a doula, a clergyman, or a family member while in childbirth.
Just so women don't have to endure childbirth alone.
This bill had some opposition.
I heard one of the representatives tell, he asked Representative Goodwin, he said, now what if they're on drugs and they're crazy and they try to bite your head off because they're in labor? And it's like, so you picturing this woman as an animal that's capable of biting somebody's head off because she's in labor? Did your wife bite your head off? The main thing was about shifting the perception that we are still women, regardless if we are incarcerated, that I am a woman first. And just because I go to prison doesn't mean that you strip me of my dignity and my humanity.
The successful passage of House Bill 3393 has inspired Ms. Monday to continue to fight to bring dignity to incarcerated women. Though progress has been slow, Ms. Monday remains hopeful about the changes Oklahoma is making.
Yes, Oklahoma has a lot of work to do to catch up. However, I'm excited to be a formerly incarcerated woman leading the movement. And everything that I'm doing is connected to a larger movement because I'm connected to other people in different places, other formerly incarcerated people in different places that are doing what I'm doing. All the bills that I've worked on have had influence or they've been crafted by formerly incarcerated women.
For Focus Black Oklahoma, I'm Crystal Patrick.
Mass incarceration is a national crisis. Oklahoma incarcerates more men and women than any other state. Tulsa introduced legislation to reduce the rates at which Black Tulsans are arrested and incarcerated. Mika Nicole brings us a story on what Oklahoma is and is not doing on the municipal level to address this issue.
Since the end of 2016, Oklahoma has had the highest incarceration rate in the world. According to a study by the Prison Policy Initiative, Oklahoma incarcerates nearly 1,079 per 100,000 residents. These statistics place Oklahoma over 50% higher than the national incarceration rate. Compared to white Oklahomans, the rate was five times higher for Blacks. In an effort to address this disparity, in January 2019, Tulsa Mayor G.T. Bynum proposed the creation of the Office of Independent Monitoring, or OIM. In September 2019, Bynum asked city councilors to pull his OIM proposal due to a lack of support from a majority of city councilors and some community leaders. North Tulsa resident and community activist Raynell Joseph believes that the OIM would have helped establish trust between police officers and the Black community.
When you think about a community and their relationship, especially Black people and a relationship with law enforcement, this would have been kind of a glimmer of hope, I think. It would have created trust.
The 2018 Tulsa Equality Indicators Report confirms that Blacks in North Tulsa are arrested more than twice as often as whites, and Black individuals are five times more likely to be a victim of officer use of force than Hispanic and Latino persons in Tulsa, while white Tulsans are only half as likely to be victims of excessive force. Since the 2018 report, Mayor Bynum released a resilient Tulsa strategy with the focus on improving racial equity. The OIM was a part of the resilient Tulsa strategy motivated by a lack of trust of the police department.
I don't know if I was surprised because I went to hear the public hearings. I saw the public hearings. And when I think about it, I feel like this sense of hurt because it's like not only do you have numbers, but you had you sat through public hearings, Mr. Mayor, your city council sat through public hearings and you had an actual face to the numbers that you put out. And even after that, you still had the audacity to pull the OIM.
Mayor Bynum was quoted in a Tulsa World article, quote, "Internal affairs investigations are conducted confidentially, and citizens don't have a means of verifying results. I think we owe it to the citizens and to the officers to do better," end quote. Bynum has since offered an alternative proposal for the OIM, which excludes use of force reviews. This did not sit well with many Tulsa citizens who were initially pleased with the possibility of holding police accountable for their excessive use of force.
Accountability, I think, is really important. I think that the OIM would have presented some form of accountability for the police officer. If law enforcement in Tulsa really feels that it's not necessary, that they're doing their work, then let the OIM be what it is. You know, if it's just to create trust, then wouldn't it be beneficial for you to have trust between the people that you are trying to develop a relationship with?
The city of Tulsa is developing an alternative to the initial proposal addressing similar goals through a different vehicle. For Focus Black Oklahoma, I'm Mika Nicole.
When discussing incarceration, things can sometimes become overwhelming and abstract because we're talking about numbers, statistics, and raw data.
We now move away from the abstraction to introduce you to two Black men who were incarcerated for over 20 years for crimes they did not commit. Negro Spiritual 121 has the story.
When we hear the terms mass incarceration, miscarriage of justice, and wrongful incarceration, we think of prison, doing time. Time is something that once is spent, we can never get it back. So no matter how much money someone may eventually be paid, there's nowhere they can go to purchase one of the days they missed. On the sunny afternoon of July 19, 2019, I met with Malcolm Scott and DeMarco Carpenter, two men arrested in Tulsa and wrongfully convicted of murder. They barely escaped spending the rest of their lives in prison. First, we hear from DeMarco, then Malcolm chimes in.
We were charged with murder, two counts with shooting with a tent, and using a vehicle to facilitate discharge of weapon. We had a life sentence for the murder, 75 years for each shooting with a 10, and 20 years for the using the drive-by, basically, the using a vehicle to facilitate a weapon. Yeah. So that's a life in 170 years.
Yeah. All consecutive.
All consecutive
sentences. Yeah. That's important that you know. Because that's basically saying you gotta, you know, die through this life sentence, wake back up somehow and go do 75 years, die again, get back up and do another 75 years.
When Malcolm and DeMarco explained the charges and the structure of their sentence, it felt like the air was being sucked out of the room. Both of their demeanors changed as they explained the hopelessness of surviving the sentence. This instinctively made me wonder, in such a bleak situation, where or how did they find the hope to continue to fight for their freedom? We hear from DeMarco, then Malcolm.
I just had to keep pushing, but definitely, you know, I was raised with my grandma. She was a God-fearing woman, and, you know, I just had my faith. My faith, it just, you know, he says it all the time.
Yeah.
You know, what did your mom tell you?
God helps those who help themselves.
And, you know, so.
I mean, it's some words that I live by. It's words that I survived through. You know what I mean? Like, it was like basically telling me, you know, when I finally understood what she was saying, you know, she told me for a long time, but when I finally understood, you know, we went through the trials and tribulations of basically growing up in prison. And you understand what I'm saying? We come from teenagers to grown men. So we grew up in prison. There's no other way to put it. And during those growing stages, you go through those rough parts, right? You know, it's like when you're growing a beard out or you're growing your hair out, you know, it's going to be a little fuzzy and a little raggedy, you know, at first. But once it gets really long, it's really nice. You know what I'm saying? It's full and you can trim it up and it looks really good. But that growing stage, that raggedy, rough stage that you go through, and we went through that part, you know, and then through those years, I couldn't hear what she was saying. You know, all I knew is I was angry. I was upset about the situation. Why am I here for something that I didn't do? Like, they know that we didn't do this. Why are we here? And it was that constant, you know, struggle and frustration to prove that, you know what I mean, and get free. And through that time, you know, you go through those rough spots. And it's like when I finally got to that point where it was like, man, this path that I'm going through to try to show that I'm innocent is actually not helping me at all. Like, this is not helping me show my innocence by, you know, getting into trouble and, you know, having so many issues and being angry and being frustrated and all these things right here. These things are not feelings and thoughts that are going to help my situation at all. You know, it's not going to get me closer to exoneration. It's not going to get me any closer to freedom.
Malcolm explained how their anger and confusion for being wrongfully convicted manifested in acting out in prison, breaking the rules. One could argue they shouldn't have been forced to follow those rules in the first place. Still, Malcolm realized he wasn't bettering his position by getting in trouble, and this was the turning point. I actually met Malcolm when I myself was incarcerated. It was great to see both Malcolm and DeMarco on the outside on that day in July. I realized both men championed family and faith as pillars that uplifted them through their 22-year-long fight for justice. However, they did not leave their fate solely in the hands of family or faith. Here's Malcolm.
Sitting up here angry and mad about it is not going to change it. What are you doing to make those changes? You know, what are you doing? Like, what type of steps are you taking to actually prove your innocence? And I had to ask myself that. Like, what are you really doing? And at that point, it was like, okay. So now it's time to start adding things to that list. You know what I mean? Daily. Make it your daily objective to find ways to help yourself prove your innocence. I had a lot of days to add up. You understand? But eventually adding up so many days. And with this man on the other side adding up days as well. You know, we took on that same mentality. Like, bro, we can't just accept this. Every day, I don't care if it's a small step. Make a step towards proving your innocence. Make a step towards making yourself free. Everything you do, from educating your mind, you know, from acts of kindness to constantly thoughts. I mean, from the letters to the, you know what I mean, to the phone calls, to the little videos we would make on YouTube that my brother made, the books, you know what I mean, the writing constantly, just finding ways, you know what I mean. It's just those little pieces that came together eventually, you know what I mean, that got us to a bigger point, and we could have finally found some people that would give us assistance to help us. But dude, it didn't just start from that. You know what I mean? People have to understand it just didn't say, oh, well, the Innocence Project came along and all of a sudden they got proved innocent. No, it wasn't that simple. They forget about all the work we did before, what was it, 2012 when they came
2011,
in?
2011, the end of
yeah, 2011. We were already in there, remember, since 1994. So it was a lot of building that went on before 2011 even got there. They were only there the last 5 years. We still had to build, you know what I mean, build that foundation from the beginning for them to even be willing to look at what we had. If we weren't already building and we had nothing to bring to them, I mean, what can we really do for you guys, is what they would have been saying. You don't have anything to show that you're innocent.
Through Malcolm and DeMarco's story, you hear the dichotomy of faith versus reality. Faith that they would see freedom again versus the reality that they had already been in prison for 2 decades on a life plus 170-year sentence. Malcolm clearly states how it was a thought and a mind shift that propelled their case forward. I propose to you it was at this point where they lined up their faith with their reality. At the intersection where a person's reality collides with what they believe, we see the impossible become possible and history is made. For Focus Black Oklahoma, I'm Negro Spiritual 121.
You're listening to Focus Black Oklahoma, a one-hour news and public affairs program on various topics relevant to the Black community statewide. And now, some headlines from across the state.
The Tulsa mayor's office has named Wendell Franklin as the new police chief. Franklin is the first Black police chief in the city's history and comes into his role at a time when racially biased policing is a major issue. Chief Franklin is a Tulsa native and has been on the police force for over 2 decades.
An Oklahoma bill that resembled stop and frisk legislation will not be enacted into law. The bill was proposed by Republican Representative David Smith from McAllister. Smith was not happy with the way the bill was written and worked to ensure that it was not moved to the House Judiciary floor.
Peter Gade, the director of graduate studies at the University of Oklahoma's School of Journalism, shocked students by equating use of the N-word to the popular ageist expression, OK Boomer. The professor, who is also white, used the slur in full to make the comparison while attempting to discuss changes in journalism related to technology and social media. Over the last 5 years, several racially insensitive incidents have occurred at OU.
Former Oklahoma Representative J.C. Watts is launching the Black News Channel to fill the gap between African American interest channels and mainstream cable news networks. BNC, based in Tallahassee, Florida, is aiming to provide culturally specific, intelligent programming that is informative, educational, inspiring, and empowering to its audience, according to a statement.
83 men and 41 women were released from Oklahoma prisons last week. This took place under Oklahoma's new commutation law. All the inmates released were serving time for drug-related offenses that are no longer considered illegal.
Last Thursday, Governor Stitt announced Oklahoma is set to resume executions by lethal injection. The state has not enforced the death penalty since 2014. The state will also continue to explore efforts of using nitrogen gas as an alternative tool for capital punishment.
Citizens are rallying to gain support to vote yes on State Question 805. This change in policy would prevent prosecutors from implementing sentence enhancements for repeat nonviolent offenders. As the law stands today, prosecutors are allowed the discretion to add additional time to a person's prison sentence if it is not his or her first criminal offense. You're listening to Focus Black Oklahoma, a news and public affairs program covering various topics relevant to the Black community statewide. You can hear our program on demand for free at publicradiotulsa.org. Look for the podcast tab and click on local podcast. Now, the first in a series of stories from contributor Christy Eaton on the power of podcasting to transform torn communities. She speaks with Somali refugees and the Harvard professors behind a newly created podcast.
Along the Somalia-Ethiopia border sit five refugee camps, home to more than 220,000 refugees from Somalia. In the oldest camp, many of the Somali refugees have been residing there for nearly 10 years. Globally, more than 2.2 million Somalis are displaced. About 10 young refugees from one camp recently took part in a program developed by two Harvard University researchers and others to test the effectiveness of podcasts in a humanitarian setting. Called Unite for a Better Life, the series of 16 podcasts focuses on teaching about healthy relationships, how to create equality in and outside the home, intimate partner violence, sexually transmitted diseases, and the use of what is known as CHOT, a stimulant that is grown in the Horn of Africa. The series follows a couple, Abdi and Fauzia, as they navigate different situations, some of them lighthearted, others quite serious. The episodes also feature other guests, including academic experts. Also, each episode presents tea time, an important tradition in Somalia, meaning that each podcast allows for the enjoyment of tea during discussion. In November and December of last year, team members fanned out across one camp and conducted a pilot study on the episode's effectiveness for behavior change. Those findings will be available in the future. Dr. Vandana Sharma is one of the researchers behind the project.
What's unique about this particular project using podcasts is its participatory and human-centered approach that actually empowers individuals to create solutions to improve their own lives and communities. So typically, programs that address intimate partner violence tend to involve in-person, participatory, or educational sessions. But in humanitarian settings where populations are mobile, a lengthy in-person intervention may not be feasible, and so innovation is really needed. So our team believes that an approach such as the podcast series could actually have a much farther reach as people could download the podcasts and share them person to person. So in a humanitarian context, this means we could reach many people very quickly.
Sharma notes that the refugee community members were involved in the design and implementation of the podcast and trained in digital storytelling. They were mentored throughout the process.
This was really important to engage the refugee community members to create the podcast themselves, as it ensured that the content is culturally relevant and context appropriate, and includes messaging that they believe will transform gender norms and behaviors within their own communities.
For senior podcaster Hoden, she believes educating women and girls is important. She has lived in one of the camps with her family for nearly 10 years and has worked and received her education. She says that when you educate a man, you educate an individual. When you educate a woman, you educate a family. For Focus Black Oklahoma, I am Christy Eaton.
Kojo Asamoah Caesar has entered his name into the District 1 congressional race. If elected, he would become the first Black person to hold that office. Kojo discussed his plans to strengthen communities by retaining untapped talent with Focus Black Oklahoma's Bracken Clark.
Kojo Asamoah Caesar is campaigning to represent Oklahoma's 1st congressional district, which includes Tulsa, Washington, Wagner counties, and parts of Rogers and Creek counties. Born to Ghanaian parents, Kojo is a first-generation American, a law school graduate who, early on in his campaign, embarked on a 50 and 50 initiative. Kojo hosted or attended 50 community events across District 1 in the first 50 days of his campaign. The purpose of this was to allow him to meet the citizens of District 1 where they are, so he could listen to their needs and concerns and ultimately build a campaign that works for every Oklahoman. In short, he's looking to build community. For Kojo, building community goes back into his college days and brought him to Tulsa in 2013 as part of Teach for America. As a teacher in Tulsa Public Schools, Kojo continued to engage and forge collaborative relationships with the students and families he worked with.
Teach for America was filling a need where you have talented folks who've gone to college, who've gone to school, who can go and do other things, but are saying, I'm going to come here and work for $32,000 a year. You know, we were 49th in the nation in per pupil, you know, funding and teacher pay. And we were coming here with energy and fervor and with a sense of mission, saying that everyone, every child deserves an excellent education, you know? And that's the mission of Teach for America. Like, your zip code should not determine, all right, your future outcomes, because you can predict, you know, you can just don't have to know any kids or their story. Just look at the zip codes and you can tell the educational outcomes of kids based on the zip code. And that is just an injustice. If the ideals of America are to be real, that all men and women are created equal, that this notion of the American dream, that if you work hard, that you can go as far as your talents, you know, can take you. If that is to be true, then that means we have to create equal access to opportunity for everybody. We have to create equal opportunity to give everybody a fair chance to apply their gifts and talents to try to fulfill their potential. We want the same opportunity, the same resources, the same access that people in South Tulsa and students in South Tulsa have. We want that to be true for kids in North Tulsa.
After completing 2 years with Teach for America, Kojo continued working in the education field, going on to be the founding principal of the Greenwood Leadership Academy. Early in 2019, Kojo had the opportunity to become the interim director of 36 Degrees North, a co-working space in Tulsa for entrepreneurs, startups, and small businesses. He approached this opportunity with an eye for building stronger, more equitable communities.
I took that role because we can't just care about the students and the kids, we have to care about their parents and their families. And so it was going to give me a temporary period of time to learn about the economic development structures in our city and how that works, and think about entrepreneurship and think about how do we ensure that we're building inclusive entrepreneurial development ecosystems where parents can be able to either participate and start their own business or get jobs. And if they have income and disposable income, then they can be able to better take care of their families and be self-sufficient and spur economic development around, you know, their neighborhoods. And so I jumped at that opportunity to be able to learn and add to the conversation, right, the stories of the parents that I've been serving in education.
All good educators share traits. A couple of those are lifelong learning and being a keen listener. Kojo appears to have taken these lessons very seriously. For Focus Black Oklahoma, I'm Bracken Clark.
Focus Black Oklahoma is a one-hour news and public affairs program on various topics relevant to the Black community statewide.
Over the last few years across the nation, Black women are starting more businesses than any other group. In Tulsa, they are opening businesses in the historic Black Wall Street District. Kiana Smith sits down with Charity Marcus to explore this story.
We will hear from Charity Marcus, the co-founder of Black Women Business Owners of America, and she is based here in Tulsa. Before we get started, a couple of quick notes. According to the 2018 State of Women-Owned Businesses Report, commissioned by American Express, while the number of women-owned businesses grew an impressive 58% from 2007 to 2018, the number of firms owned by Black women grew by 164%, nearly three times the rate. Women now own 30% of all businesses in the U.S., and African-American women control 14% of those businesses. Charity, tell me more about what inspired you to create Black Women Business Owners of America here in Tulsa.
Yes, thank you for having me. It started off with another Black woman entrepreneur and I talking and really just getting together and saying, hey, we're tired of seeing only us in spaces. And then we kind of recognized that she knew Black women entrepreneurs that I didn't know. And then I knew Black women entrepreneurs that she didn't know. And so we got together to say, like, well, let's invite all of these women together and let's just have a monthly brunch. From there, it turned into something much more. So what initially started off with about 65 women throughout the Tulsa metropolitan area quickly grew to 150 within a week. And then that's when we kind of knew that we needed to do something more sustainable and a more long-term effort into ensuring that we were connected and getting the access to the resources that we all needed.
What role do you see Black women playing in the revitalization of Black Wall Street?
I think we have to look at revitalizing Black Wall Street from two perspectives. One, the actual geographical location. We have so many Black women entrepreneurs now that are popping up physically in Black Wall Street, which is essential to keeping that history alive and well. But then we also have to look at Black Wall Street from a cultural perspective. When you're looking at Black Wall Street and what it means and the history that it carries so that we can also look at how we are playing a role in that. So the McKinsey Consulting Group has a report out right now on the state of Black wealth. And it says that if Black families had the same amount of wealth as white families, it would essentially inject $1 to $1.5 trillion back into our economy, plus increase our GDP 4 to 6%. So when you're looking at Black women who are predominantly the ones that are head of household and taking care of their families, having Black women being able to provide, it's going to help with Black wealth and also help our economy grow.
What unique supports do Black women have here in Tulsa to add to this space?
Well, beyond Black Women Business Owners of America, we also have the Tulsa Economic Development Corporation, which is headed up by Rose Washington. And they help people to get non-traditional loans where they normally wouldn't be able to get them at the bank. So I think really funding is key to making sure that we have the leg up in the success that everybody else has when it comes to building funds. A lot of us are not able to go to friends and family first. So having that opportunity to go through an organization like TEDC, as well as Kiva Tulsa, which does 0% interest loans up to $10,000, that is a vital step up for what we need. And then from our philanthropic standpoint, we have some amazing nonprofits that focus specifically on entrepreneurship. So making sure that the women are getting plugged into that space as well is definitely vital.
How are Black women uniquely positioned to be entrepreneurs?
When you're looking at our cultural history, from Harriet Tubman to Rosa Parks to the many women that are out advocating today, we have historically been the ones to champion a lot of our cultural issues. And so I think it's time for us to shift gears and start to champion our community economics. And so we're definitely in position to do that. Not only are we the ones that mainly champion these issues and causes, but we're also the most educated class and group of people out there. So we should be able to take our wherewithal plus our knowledge and our resilience and start creating economic empowerment within our communities, and not only within our communities, but within our cities, in our state, and our country.
Now, let's fast forward to 2021. Where do you see Black women entrepreneurs in Tulsa? How are they going to play a leading hand in revitalizing Black Wall Street?
I see Black women, specifically here in Tulsa, playing a vital role in our commemoration. You have to remember, Black Wall Street was all about economic opportunity, economic prosperity. So now we're looking at how do we continue that legacy moving forward. And with companies like Silhouette Sneakers, with companies like AOG Real Estate, and companies like Wanda J's, Blowout Hair Salon, Rose Tax Solutions, all of these are Black women-owned businesses right there on Black Wall Street. We're already playing that role.
Charity, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you guys for having me.
For Focus Black Oklahoma, I'm Kiana Smith.
Elements and rights in session. Lesson about upon the block, hustling in bomber jacket. Concrete jungle where the ones who got the strength bleed less.
Finally, we offer a story on Black artists, musicians, and promoters encountering discrimination at venues across Tulsa. This piece is the first in a series from our contributor, written Quincy.
+100 to the floor on the gas. My pseudonym's a masked man. Black gloves in a couple duffel bags.
Beneath the rumble, low bass of trap 808s. Kicks of foot pedals, snares, and hi-hats. Lead vocals from raspy tenor, bellowing, classic soul ballads, melodic call and response. DJ strategically and masterfully selecting tempos that manipulate spirits. He's a medium. A shaman of the dance floor, dance hall, dub and house. Griot storytell from village microphones. Microphone cords and quarter inch and power cords knotted and tangled resemble Koa Tempontli of Tula, pulled from duffel bags. Shh. There is murmuring in the nightlife, Black urban nightlife. A sentiment that between promoters, artists, performers, and venues, that a specific type of crowd isn't really welcome in the town, Tulsa. Specifically, too many Blacks, brown-skinned humans. In this segment, we will explore an experience in Tulsa nightlife where venues and establishments discriminate against Black artists and promoters and events organizers through what I coin the Brown Code. In this first of a series of interviews, promoter Cottrell Barnes, a native of Tulsa, and I build on his experience over the last decade of promoting parties, concerts, and events. We discussed the discrimination and the feeling. The feeling one gets when confronted by it. It feels like...
It doesn't feel like you're in control of your own success. You know what I mean? So you have to tiptoe and walk on eggshells in order to get something, to have a piece of your what you're after. You know what I mean? As far as like success and throwing an event. Mm-hmm. So the only way to even make it happen, the only way to see your vision through is you got to give up so much. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I don't want to use the term bow down, but for lack of better words, you know, it's close to bowing down and being humble, you know, just so you can have an opportunity to give your people, your own people, you know what I mean, some safe entertainment.
And not only what it feels like, even what it looks like.
Instead of just saying, hey, look, I don't like, you know, your crowd, they say, well, we're kind of looking for something a little, you know, a little different. And then you ask them, you know, what do you mean by different? Well, just something a little different. You know, it's very evasive when it comes to answering. It's like a political answer. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to read between the lines. Man, it's 2016. It's 2017, 18, 19, 20. You know what I mean? And we still dealing with some of the same stuff that our parents dealt with 40 years ago. Like, you know, no Blacks allowed. You know, it's like, why don't y'all just put that sign up? You know what I mean? But I'm thinking it's all good. Like, That sign has been torn down. So I thought. But y'all let me know that you still got that sign back in that office somewhere, waiting to pull it out. You know what I mean?
I asked if he noticed the change in the last decade of how black crowds were accepted in Tulsa.
Not really. The biggest thing that I've seen is more of us blacks with resources have decided to step up and own our own venue. I'm going to pursue this, but I'm going to pursue it by owning my own. I'm not going to let anybody stop me.
Finally, I asked him about the future of black nightlife in Tulsa.
I think as more and more of us put our resources together and decide we're going to take our vision back and make it our vision again and see it through, that in places like Kansas City, when I lived in Kansas City, seeing in places like St. Louis, I lived in St. Louis, predominantly black cities, you know, where you got a multitude of black business owners own clubs and they're doing it and they're successful and they're able to draw a crowd, you know what I mean, draw their own people in and seeing them being able to do it. If they can do it there, we can do it here. And as more and more of us believe it, you know, it'll become a reality.
For Focus Black Oklahoma, this is Ridden Quincy.
Evans to melanin and elements and writing session. Lesson about upon the block, hustling in bomber jacket. Concrete jungle where the ones who got the strength bleed less. And we owe y'all the way we take turns. Blow trees fearlessly. I want it all to eat in my tiramisu. Remember me.
Focus Black Oklahoma is produced in partnership by Public Radio Tulsa, the Tulsa Artists Fellowship, and Tri-City Collective, and is broadcast from the studios of Public Radio Tulsa on the campus of the University of Tulsa.
Our theme music is by Moffitt Music. The executive producers of Focus Black Oklahoma are Quraysh Ali Lanzana and Scott Gregory.
A fact in the matter, or is the pole that hold a flag? A dagger in the back, we put the swagger in our culture. Ask us why I leave our side, why we wish a nigga would carry that dang that gold black, black. Head rapping the do-rag, the way we do that, we the birth of the boom-bap. We about to birth that boom-bap.